Okay, this is continuing with Arthur Covington on 23rd June, 76. Now, what were you working on at the radiation lab at Cal Berkeley? Just roughly...
Oh, yes, it was keeping the magnetron tuned up, the cyclotron tuned up,
mm-hmm.
so that the beam would stay on the target.
Right.
Well, I had two programs, the experiments and physics viewer, and then a certain part of the time was allocated to radiation, to radiating patients. Lawrence's brother was a medical man, and it was quite remarkable that the two developments, the physical and the medical, should go along side by side.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there are all sorts of things like cleaning out the D's and tuning it up, putting in heavy water, and peeking behind curtains to see that the patients have been put in place, and then punching the button.
Right.
All the time, you see, I was a Canadian in a foreign atmosphere, and as the atomic bomb development, everybody knew what was going on, more or less.
Yeah.
Then a number of pressures came on. There was a curfew. I was exempt from the curfew, but professors such as C. Gray, who was of Italian background, had to be off the streets by 7 o'clock. And,
was this a general curfew for the population?
Aliens.
I didn't realize that.
This was after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. But Canadians were accepted?
I guess I had all the clearances. I know I have all the cards. I can't recall the details quickly. In any case, the radar development in Canada had proceeded. And I'd been getting letters of various kinds. And in May, I finally left the radiation lab to pursue the radar program in Ottawa, mm-hmm. the National Research Council.
Mm-hmm. And who was running that program?
Well, that's quite a complicated story that I think I'd rather not go into right here.
Okay.
It has some connections. There are a lot of them. I just can't immediately recall.
But what were you working on at the NRC?
Oh, when I arrived there first. This would be July 42. The radar program of the National Research Council was conducted at a radio field station about 10 miles south of Ottawa. And again, it was behind a screened fence and a fair amount of security. And the first task I was assigned was to help someone who was trying to excite a fairly large IQ cavity at a low rate,
mm-hmm.
and then discharge it suddenly so that a pulse of energy could be generated of quite intense peak power.
Mm-hmm.
Never worked, but at least I learned something about standing wave ratios on transmission lines.
Mm-hmm.
And if I recall correctly, the next job I was given was to work on a 30 megacycle IF strip. And it was quite an experience because it was the first time I'd worked with feedback. The feedback, of course, is used to widen the bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the general radar program had progressed so that the senior staff at the radio field station advocated the 10-centimeter program for 3-centimeter and 1-centimeter program. And in time, I was transferred to look after essentially the 10-centimeter microwave components.
I see.
And this involved magnetrons, TR boxes, and transitions of various kinds.
Right. How would you describe the work that was being done at this laboratory relative to that at the MIT radiation laboratory? Was it sort of in parallel?
Oh. It was in parallel. In fact, I made one trip to Boston to see the MIT lab. Historically, it's fairly well known that the microwave work of the National Research Council had about a 3-month head start over that of the MIT radiation lab. And this occurred because the Tizard mission from England mm-hmm. first stopped in at Ottawa before going on to Washington.
Right. Bringing the information about the English results, which they had decided to share.
Oh yes, the 10-centimeter magnetron, which is so famous in the development of radar,
mm-hmm.
it was brought to Ottawa first. We had access to it for 48 hours, so I've been told. non-destructive testing.
Non-destructive testing.
Thing right. was x-rayed and I guess measured and
right.
talked about, but that was about all.
Hmm.
It was a very, very secure situation, I believe. Somebody was always attached to it.
Yeah. Did this 3-month lead hold out throughout the whole war? Are you implying?
No, of course. Then you get into the situation between Canada and the United States population question.
Sure.
There's
so much more resources.
10 Americans to one Canadian.
Yeah. But so that's what I was wondering. Did you specialize in some area? Were you coordinating programs?
There was a liaison officer. I mentioned Berkeley particularly, the radiation lab, as the liaison officer for Canada to the United States was a man by the name of Fred Saunders, who was a graduate of Berkeley, probably 28 or 29, I've
mm-hmm.
forgotten the exact date, but it could be all dug out of the records.
Yeah.
And he was a classmate to Condon.
Ed Condon?
Ed Condon.
Yeah.
And so the liaison between Canada and the United States was done through Fred Saunders
at
this sort of level. The actual contact between the technical contact between the Tizard mission and the National Research Council was through John T. Henderson. In 1957, he was president of the IRE.
I see.
And,
well, so you stayed at the NRC throughout the whole war, I guess.
Yes.
Working on radar. And then what happened when the war was over?
Oh, I guess in the first place, being a scientist who'd been recruited for such work, most of the fellows wanted to quit and go back to school or get a job. Or a large number of them became interested in atomic energy. It was something new, and some of them had been involved.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Canadian government had set up the atomic energy development at Chalk River. And it'd be interesting to figure out the exact fraction of our radar probe engineers who subsequently went to Chalk River.
Yeah.
And I think this makes a tremendous difference in how Canadian radio astronomy developed in reference to the Australian radio astronomy. As you probably
know. Or British,
know.
Yeah.
Yes, I hadn't thought about the British, yes.
But
probably the same factor. The Americans were so tied up with atomic energy that they just couldn't see radio astronomy.
Right.
Have you?
Well, I'm puzzled. I have some ideas, but I'm puzzled why American radio astronomy lagged for so long. And this may be part of the reason, is to look into what fields the people from the MIT Rad Lab, for instance, went into and so forth. That might give some good insight into what caused it. But anyway, what was your own decision at this time? You decided to stay at NRC, I guess.
Yes, this would be in 1945, the end of 45. I approached my immediate superior, W.J. Henderson. Well, he was a cyclotron engineer at Purdue University.
And, mm-hmm.
Both of us knew about the secret development of the atomic energy, and when the newspaper report came that there'd been an explosion, atomic explosion in Japan, we just looked at one another and said, mm-hmm. gosh, they've done it. We yeah. hardly believed our eyes.
Yeah.
I think both of us felt that the task was so out of this world, that beyond human.
That it wouldn't happen, yeah.
Yes. Subsequently, W.J. Henderson became a radiation safety officer at the Chalk River Development.
I see.
And when there was a breakdown in the reactor there, he wrote the final analysis. You can find all this buried in the literature somewhere.
Right, right. But you were talking about going to him with your proposal for what you wanted to work on.
Oh, yes. He was in charge of what we call the tube lab. In addition to the Canadians developing the magnetron independently of the United States, we developed other tubes like the Klystron. We call it, it's a Sutton tube, McNally-Pierce tube. And as the war went on, they went to higher and higher frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the war, I wasn't wondering what to do. The authorities, the National Research Council people, wanted to get out of military work as quickly as possible, and so we were given much of a free hand. And I approached W.J. Henderson and told him about my reading of Groot Reber's work, amateur radio astronomy, and
mm-hmm.
we had all this radar equipment, and it was so easy to put together something
right.
and
right.
try and experiment. And this happened to be on the wavelength of 10.7 centimeters, which had been dictated more or less by the magnetron that Tizard brought over.
Right, right. Which you said in turn was just a very arbitrary thing that had to do with just the hole sizes.
Well, not entirely. I mentioned one story that had come down that having settled or trying to push the wavelength as short as possible, there came the time of drilling a hole in a block of copper to determine the dimensions of the magnetron. And it happened to be the tool used to
yeah.
pull out the hub of a bicycle.
Right. Yeah.
So that probably determines why the wavelength is 10.7 centimeters, or 10 centimeters
right.
rather than 8 or 12 or
right.
something.
When did you read Reber's work for the first time?
Oh, when I was at university, I recall browsing through the library, and in one magazine, again, my recollections are not clear, there was a picture of Groot Reber's telescope
mm-hmm.
in Illinois.
Yeah.
I was working on the electron microscope at the time, and of course, the ideas are somewhat related. I'd even thought of the idea of putting an electron microscope somewhere in the eyepiece of an ordinary telescope to produce light amplification.
Yeah, an image tube.
An image tube. Yeah. But of course, that never materialized beyond thinking
yeah.
of it. But so subsequently, I have looked back in some of these old journals, and at that time, Reber's work was fairly well advertised.
Yes, right. He had several articles at the time. And so you decided that this looked like it was worth following up.
Yes, and permission was given, and there are two aspects of building the radiometer and building the radio telescope. I had the radiometer going in early 1946, and the radio telescope was completed in 1946, the summer of 46.
And what was that telescope?
It's a 4-foot reflector, which was taken off the GL-3C radar. GL standing for gun laying, 3, Mark 3, and the C for the Canadian version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, when I talked about that radar set, I have heard and seen it written that immediately after Pearl Harbor, the Canadian authorities, the military authorities, shipped one of these sets to Panama Canal, because the Americans at that time didn't have such high definition radar sets.
In order to defend the Panama Canal, you know.
The radar sets at Pearl Harbor, I believe, were 200 megacycles.
Mm-hmm. And what were these radars?
The Canadian ones,
right.
They were the 2800 megahertz, 10.7.
I see. Yeah,
there.
Sure, okay. And was this equatorially mounted?
The radio telescope turned out to be a real hybrid. It had the GL, the gun-laying reflector, and the axis was part of a Marine, the 268 radar, which was set at an angle, a polar angle,
mm-hmm.
and carried a rotating coupler. And it was a real hybrid of various things. And we put it on the sun, as I recall, in July the 26th. It was one day after a big flare had occurred on the sun.
Mm-hmm.
The sunspot was visible with the naked eye, and in the evenings of that period, I can recall seeing the sunspot when the sun was low in the horizon.
Hmm.
And the frustrations of not being able to complete the fabrication in time to get some observations.
Yeah.
As it was, we were one day, we missed the big flare by one day.
Hmm. Now, as you were building the radiometer and the dish, was your objective solar observations to begin anyway?
Oh no, I was going to cosmic noise. In fact, we created some files with the title of Research in Cosmic Noise.
I see. And because of Reber, you were influenced by his maps, yes. And so forth. And you wanted to see what they were at a higher frequency, I guess.
Yes, the sun was just incidental.
Yeah.
And I think part of this was flavored by what Southworth had done.
Mm-hmm.
As you recall,
right.
Southworth had discovered solar emission in the microwave band,
right.
In 1943.
Right. Did you know about this before the publication at the end of the war?
Yes, so we've known about Southworth's results because through our scientific liaison there was an exchange of documents. On the other hand, I knew nothing about Hayes' work.
Hmm.
The English liaison was a bit more remote and I think a bit more severe.
Mm, I see. Do you still have a copy of this wartime document? I've never seen that. That would be very interesting.
I suppose it exists in our files. I've looked at, well, you know, you get roomfuls of files, and it could be an interesting thing to dig out.
Yeah, I'd be very interested to see what it says. So you knew about this work, but you were planning to do the galactic background radiation, as it's called now. So what happened when you first got something working?
Well, the idea was to, the sun there, the sun was present with a beautiful sunspot, and of course the obvious thing, I think scientists are somewhat of an opportunist, just to try it out.
Right.
And the first observations were made when the drive motor was not complete, so all I could get was a drift current.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have the records of a simple bell-shaped curve which represents the sun passing through the beam of the antenna.
Mm-hmm.
Well then, a bit of an excitement, there it is.
Yeah.
And then the
sure.
next question was a polarization, the dipole, a single dipole, and I think I rotated the dipole through 90 degrees to see if there was any polarization in the
mm-hmm.
solar emission. And right away I established that the two orthogonal components are more or less equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all that I did today, that particular day. The next question, of course, was the intensity factor. You see the qualitative results, and then try to figure out, well, is that the, what do the numbers mean?
Right, let's calibrate this thing. Were you interested in using the sun as a calibration source for the antenna beam at all? Was that another motivation to look at the sun? Or?
No, at that time, calibrations were completely open.
So you just took the size of the beam as being roughly lambda over D? And...
The factors that don't enter into calibration are the gain, which is really to the equivalent area of the dish.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that fairly well from radar work.
That's true, yes.
The main unknown was the sky background, which the sun is projected against. Now, the beam width of the antenna is about 7 degrees, so there's an awful lot of empty sky. And I think my first guess, we really didn't know what the temperature of the empty sky was.
Mm-hmm. At this wavelength, right.
I just can't recall what I did next.
You didn't take it to zero, though?
No. I know I didn't take it to zero. You know, as you go to the shorter wavelengths, the water absorption starts to
right.
come in. So there'd be a certain thermal emission from the water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere. Then there was the question of the emission from the ionosphere and possibly ground reflections in the ionosphere. Since I'm not a theoretically inclined person, it was definitely the experimental approach that I took. And it involved calibrating the radiometer against using a load of some kind. At one stage, I'm not quite sure when, I remember making a resistive load which could be plunged into a flask of liquid nitrogen, because that would get you a temperature considerably below room temperature.
Was this a technique that had been used at the NRC lab before?
Not that I know of. It's sort of the obvious thing to do. For very small temperature variations, I'd been using a piece of platinum wire matched into a waveguide and heating it with an electrical current.
I see.
From its resistance, of course, you can calibrate its temperature. Those were for tens and twenties of degrees. Well, finally, there are a number of stages here which I can't quite recollect quickly. But the ultimate outcome of a lot of experimentation was to make a radio black box about 18 inches as a cube. And this was placed over the dipole in the 4-foot dish. And there had been a lot of theoretical discussion of this problem by an Englishman, Burgess, R.E. Burgess.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And just following the theory that he had outlined, there's equilibrium between the black box and the termination you put to
right.
the antenna, which is connected to the space of the black box. And this proved very satisfactory. And later on, I made another black box in which I could heat it to various high temperatures. And in that case, I would extrapolate down in towards absolute zero. And it involved having a good detector to avoid curvature errors.
Now, this black box, was the dipole inside it while it was mounted on the antenna, or was this on the bench?
The black box could be mounted right on the antenna. And we stuck a thermometer in it, so you would get then a measure of the temperature of the emission. It has the advantage of eliminating all the ohmic losses in the transmission line.
Right,
and so on.
Right.
In any case, the result of these experiments, I think I assigned, I'd have to check, 50 degrees absolute for the sky temperature. And then once I determined this, I decided to start observing the sun, making use of emission from the black box at 50 degrees, and then using the temperature emission. I was the 50 degrees is assigned to the zenith.
Right.
And the black box supplies the ambient temperature. Well, then you have two levels, and then you can find what the solar emission is. That same system is being used even today.
So it seems like right from the very beginning, then, you spent quite a bit of time on absolute calibration of your measurements.
One theoretical... The black box was always a source of discussion and argument. People will say, well, it isn't a black box. Cosmic rays can go through it.
Yeah, right.
Whenever an astronomer would visit the institute, they'd see the radio black box. Of course, they're familiar with optical black boxes.
Right.
The endless discussions. And it was a remarkably easy way to enable someone familiar with the optical field to enter this new radio field.
Yeah, right. But now, I'm just noticing that the first publication that I have down by you is in Nature in 1947, in which you talked about the partial solar eclipse in November 46. It seems like you did not talk at all about these first observations. You did not publish them only when this eclipse came along. Is that correct?
I got sidetracked into monitoring the noise from the zenith, the sky background, and there's a prior publication to the eclipse observations.
Terrestrial Magazine?
Yes.
One?
But the partial eclipse came along suddenly, and I was more or less unprepared for it. We had made the initial observations out of gust, and then decided to tear the equipment apart to make improvements. And then about 2 weeks before the partial eclipse, my wife told me from a newspaper account that partial eclipse was occurring.
I see.
What was I doing, though?
Right.
That certainly put the bee in my bonnet. I was able to approach our shop manager and get priorities, and some of the staff worked overtime, and one day before the eclipse we had the equipment reassembled and operational.
Right.
It was a very fortunate situation because, as I recall, it was November the 21st, and the day turned out to be beautifully clear, and we could watch the whole partial eclipse through dark glasses, and watch the record, radio record, and various contacts. There was a large spot on the disk at the time, and you could certainly see when it was being covered up by the moon or uncovered.
Yeah, I have a note here that you determined what the temperature of that sunspot group was from this as 1.5 million degrees.
Yes.
Which was one of the very earliest determinations of the high temperature of a sunspot group, or the fact of the localization of these high temperature regions. But now, you also have that the temperature of the quiet sun was 5,600 kelvins. 5,600, the quiet sun part of it.
I recall 56,000.
Well, maybe I copied it wrong, or maybe it was misprinted. Okay, yes. 56,000. But now, had you determined from non-eclipse observations also this temperature?
No, it was the first real calculation I had done.
I see. But why could you? You could have done it from the non-eclipse days just as well, could you not? Take a day when...
Not for the sunspot, because the...
Not for the sunspot, no. But the quiet part of the sun.
I suppose we could have, more or less, yes.
But it's
I just didn't do
you
it.
You just didn't do it. The clips goaded you into making some calculations. But tell me about the microwave sky noise and how what you did for that. I'm interested in these bursts or whatever.
Well, that's rather a lost cause at this stage, although there are one or two observations which I still stand by. But of course, they don't really...
But can you just describe what the nature of the phenomenon was?
Oh, I see. As is well known, the sun, the flares occur on the sun, and these produce ionospheric disturbances. At this time, scientists were quite critical, and many of them assumed that the radio bursts were really radio emission from the disturbed ionosphere. And to sort of counter this argument, I actually for a while had two radiometers and two radio telescopes in operation, one following the sun and one pointing toward the zenith all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if the background emission was enhanced, there would be a registration in both radiometers. If it were true solar origin, only one would respond. It's interesting to know that I think Appleton and Hay recorded in their early observations one source of radio noise coming from the magnetic north, and this was part of the argument that the solar noise bursts were of terrestrial origin.
I see. Well, I'm not familiar, at least with published papers, arguing this point. Do you remember that there were such papers?
Yes, I can supply the reference.
Mm. Yes, I'd like to.
And also, Reber, in one of his notes, can recall hearing certain kinds of swishes at nighttime and in daytime, and he was thinking that some of these noise bursts were locally produced by the energetic mm-hmm. particles coming in.
Yeah. So anyway, you got some bursts which were coming only from the zenith, not from the sun. Or how was it?
Oh, well, there were a few bursts coming from the zenith. To see how they related with magnetic storms and so on, I approached the Dominion Observatory and examined magnetic records. And
mm-hmm.
there are a few good examples of coincidence. By and large, most of the bursts were of solar origin.
Mm.
That is, originating in the radiometer and radio telescope, which is far
right.
from the sun.
And this phenomenon, you say, is still not really resolved as to...
Well, periodically, it keeps coming up again. It's really hasn't been nailed down.
Right. No one's spent the time doing it properly.
That's right.
Maybe, I think you should do it. You're the only one that's going to do it.
Oh, I don't know.
You've got the equipment, you've got the patience to monitor. Okay, if I go on to your next publication, that was the really the first major one in Proceedings of the IRE in 48, in which you established that there was a 27-day periodicity.
Well, coming back to the eclipse observations, I think they were the ones which really... suddenly shot me from an obscure lab technician into someone in the
okay.
forefront of radio astronomy. And in that connection, there's another incident which has yet to be recorded. During the war, Sir Edward Appleton was secretary of... many organizations, and of course then there was the classic paper of Appleton and Hay, so
right.
we knew all about radio astronomy and its implication.
Right.
And he'd spent much of his time during the war in England, and after were in it. He was given a trip to North America. I think he was giving the lectures to Arthur D. Little Company. He gave the first honorary lecture.
I see.
And either coming or going from that presentation, he stopped in at Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to be 1 or 2 days after the eclipse. Now our management, of course, quite anxious to show Sir Edward the what had been accomplished.
Right.
And I can remember the great pains we went to cleaning the desks and
right.
benches. And in one particular case, in order to save time, we made a 7-foot or 10-foot wooden stair to go over a security fence.
Well, just for his visit.
Just for his visit. Yeah. I came back with the eclipse records. I knew about Sir Edward's account of solar noise bursts and his plea for the construction of large radio telescopes to single out the emission from radio spots. All this is published in Nature somewhere.
Well, I'm not sure about his plea for large telescopes. Is that also
yes.
published in Nature?
Yes.
Okay.
And,
I'll have to check that.
I hope I'm right.
Yeah.
Or there may be some variation. I may
yeah.
be being somewhat free.
Yeah, okay, I'll check that out.
And I remember standing by the bench and waiting for his arrival. It came with the president of NRC and other high officials. And as soon as Sir Edward saw what had happened, everything clicked and he started talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to realize I explained everything. He wanted to know more and more. And I presume a lot of time for
right.
Sir Edward talking to me was rapidly vanishing.
Yeah.
And the president of NRC was looking at me, daggers and so on. And he finally interrupted him, but I could hardly stop the enthusiasm.
Yeah, right. And were you able to demonstrate the dish also?
Not at that time. I showed him the equipment. But he made a point when he returned to England of sending me some autographed reprints.
Mm. I see. So he was obviously impressed by this this setup. But I know another question before we go any further is, obviously, you got hooked on the sun by this point, and you forgot the cosmic noise part. How did that exactly happen?
Oh, well, I guess that goes back to a good physics professor. We had a course in spectroscopy. Well, a professor is Arthur Crooker. University of Toronto graduate, and he's isolated some of the lines in lead.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first possibilities of a research thesis for an MA was to tackle the lines of iodine. I looked at iodine and I realized that I couldn't be a spectroscopist.
Yeah.
But in these discussions, he mentioned iron 14 and Edlund's work and
mm-hmm.
mysterious coronium and
right.
so on. So I was well versed in the high temperature of the corona as discovered by spectroscopy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after making the calculation for the solar eclipse and coming up with this 1.5 million degrees, and coupled with the fact that the Australians had already, from metric wave work, the same temperature,
right,
the thing
right.
began to fit together. And being in the radio branch and also aware of SIDs and the need of a good solar index, I began to realize that this program was not for galactic work. On top of that, I tried looking for galactic emission and none was evident.
I see.
So here is a really good little program.
Right.
Do with it.
Right.
You just keep it going.
What are SIDs?
Sudden ionospheric disturbances.
Yes. Right. So then you decided that solar was the way to go, and what got you onto the thing of which, of course, is your whole career's work, namely the daily monitoring. I mean, this began almost right from the very beginning, didn't it?
Not quite, but it did. It's again this... I don't know how I became aware of the need of a good solar index. In Ottawa, there was a group devoted to ionospheric work. This is Frank Davies, Jim Scott, Jack Mead. During the war, they set up a chain of ionospheric stations in northern Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in turn, were stimulated by Appleton. And people here in the United States in Washington, the Carnegie Institution.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have been through, you know, casual conversations of these people. Solar control of the ionosphere. We have these sunspot numbers, dark blotches on the sun.
Right.
How on earth can the ionosphere increase the ionization in the ionosphere?
Right, right.
Well, with this 1.5 million degree area with a sunspot, the thing began to come to a head.
So, were you talking with any solar optical astronomers?
None whatsoever.
Yeah. Not at all.
Oh, yes, I must qualify that. Because of the Dominion Observatory, they had a solar telescope there. It's a horizontal type and takes an image of the sun about 14 inches in diameter. During the eclipse of November, they fortunately took a series of photographs of
mm-hmm.
the positions of sun and moon, and it was from these that I was able to find the exact times when the moon covered
right.
the sunspot. But other than that, a bit more is coming back. During the war, the Dominion Observatory was staffed by quite a senior staff. You see, it was wartime conditions, and these astronomers were nearing the end of their career. And it was pretty well run down, I
yeah.
hate to use the word,
right.
but that's what it was. And it was Mr. O'Connor who supplied the photographs of the geometrical positions of the sun and moon. Then there is a Ralph DeLury. You'll find considerable references to the rotation of the sun about 1920s. It was quite a problem then. He established a reputation.
I see.
But in talking with him, he drove home to me the need to measure the sun's ultraviolet emission somehow or other.
Mm-hmm.
Late in his career, he became quite concerned in trying to relate solar activity to growth of trees and flights of birds, weather,
yeah.
yes.
Now, when did you talk to him, though, for the first time?
It was after the eclipse.
After the eclipse.
Yes, after
yeah.
the
but
eclipse.
But early in 47 sometime then. You think?
Well, it was a few days after the eclipse. I went over
I see. Oh, that's right, because he's the one that had the photographs, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
But the discussions lasted until about 6 months. It was a 6 months conversation.
So when did you actually...